session number 10180, reel 8.
John Hatfield, Reel 8. From B, HMS B, you went on to Great Yarmouth.
Yes, we went to Yarmouth, again, coast hopping, calling in at Portland, and I mean at Poole and at Dover and so on. We eventually got to Great Yarmouth, which I'd never been to before. And there we joined the rest of the flotilla. There were also a few other flotillas, including gunboats of the similar class, or other kinds of classes in between, which were not very typical. The idea was to operate against coastal shipping on the Dutch coast, and therefore I could see that the it was going to be rather hard weather and very difficult operations. And some of the boats had actually, not in my flotilla, had actually been used to take agents over to the resistance in Holland. So it all seemed very exciting.
Can you remember your first... I presume you did a few training.
Yes, we did still a lot of training at that stage. And my main memory is of the long hours I spent correcting charts and doing exercises in navigation and generally getting the boat operational. I didn't actually go on any operations in that boat, because I left it a little while after we got there. I don't remember how many months after. And that was my great failure during the war, that I didn't get on with the captain, I didn't do my navigation well enough, and he thought I ought to be moved to do some further training. And I felt very despondent about this. But one of the senior officers ashore who were in command of operationally tried to console me, and you know, said things like, "Well, if you give a dog a bad name, sort of, you'll get over it," kind of thing.
So you never actually went on.
So I didn't go on operations in that boat, no, in that flotilla. I remember the letter that the captain wrote. He had to give me a sort of recommendation according to naval rules. He did it fairly kindly, in which he said that my behaviour was good and moderate on this and moderate on that, and then he said, "Is always very clean and well turned out and smartly dressed." And I remember being deeply insulted by this, because it sounded as though that was the best thing he could think to say about me. Anyway, so what happened then was two things. One was that I wrote a letter off to the Admiralty requesting, as you were allowed to do, a different type of thing. I thought, well, now's the time when I can try and use my languages, and requesting to join naval intelligence, which I didn't know what that meant, but I thought it sounded good.
So you didn't want to stay in
MTBs? I did want to stay in MTBs, but I thought that I'd had it, that I was going to be branded as no good, etc.
Were you actually sent for this refresher course?
Yes, I did. I went to HMSB again, and I did some extra work on navigation, and I believe that as a result of that I ended up better than most of my contemporaries, because nobody had had time to do very much training in the normal course. All I did was to do the same sort of thing as before, but in greater depth, and what I needed was confidence, really.
Did you get it there?
Yes, oh yes, I did, and I felt much better by that time.
And it was, what was it, before or during this that you wrote to the Admiralty?
Before, yes, before. And then I heard nothing, so I thought, well, that's just a waste of time, a typical stupid thing to do. Anyway, so then I went on home leave again and got appointed, out of the blue, by another of these letters from my Lord's Commissioners, to go to Gibraltar on the staff of the Admiral.
When would that be?
When? That would be, I think, round about early 43, yes, about April, February, or between February and March, February, March, April, probably March or April.
And you'd left the 621 sometime around January, February, I presume.
Yes, something like that, yes. So, I was annoyed at being posted ashore, because it seemed a disgrace, you see, continuing my disgrace. On the other hand, it was very interesting. So, I quite enjoyed it. I was there for a year in Gibraltar, on the staff of the flag officer, North Atlantic Station. His name changed, his title changed, but it was basically that. Now, I arrived there just after the invasion of North Africa had taken place, which had been masterminded from Gibraltar. And I worked in the naval operations room, which was in a tunnel right underneath the rock. And I lived in a flat. Well, eventually, I first of all lived in a hotel, and then I shared a flat with some Air Force people. Then I eventually shared a better flat with some other naval officers. So we used to go to work every day, walking or on a bicycle, if we were on morning shift, morning watch. And two things, the job consisted of two separate things. One was to help to run a wireless station, as it was called in those days, which was right on top of the rock, whose job was to listen to German submarines. Y intelligence, it was called. And the other was to be on watch in the chart operations room, where there was in the plot room, where there was an enormous plot on a huge table and several on the walls, run by a mixture of naval officers and Wrens, mostly Wren officers.
What was the plot of?
The Atlantic. The Battle of the Atlantic. The eastern part of the Battle of the Atlantic. Our responsibility went from the latitude of just south of Gibraltar right up to Britain, but the eastern half, as far as the western approaches, which was another command where the admiral in Britain took over.
How did you distribute your time between these two responsibilities?
Well, there were four officers of at the beginning, I think what happened was that if you were on watch, you either did it in the daytime or at night. Now, if you were on at night, in the daytime, you'd go up to the wireless station and see that everything was working okay. Otherwise, one of the others did it. I don't remember the exact routine, because it depended on how many officers we had, and towards the end, there was only myself left, and I did everything.
Right. Can we look at this
yes.
Y intelligence wireless station? Can you go in some detail as to what
yes.
exactly your responsibilities were, and what the function of
yes. Well, the function was to listen to U-boat signals, because, and I'm not sure how much of this is classified, and you'll have to check this, but the U-boats had a special system by which they would surface briefly, fire off an extremely brief signal to their headquarters, which would tell the headquarters where they were, and they would receive an instruction what to do. And this was part of the way they were controlled. Now, the British had managed to refine the way of listening into these and would pick up these very rapid signals. As soon as that was done, the operator would shout, and the direction-finding equipment, which was nearby, would be put into operation. They'd try and get a fix on the direction and the range. This was signaled to a network of other similar wireless stations in Britain and all over in Britain, the Azores and other places, which allowed a network of direction-finding beams to be interlocked. And with any luck, you got a position, a fix of the U-boat. But it was usually something like within 120 miles of latitude so-and-so, longitude so-and-so. Sometimes it was within 60 miles, but the accuracy was very, very low. So this was then fed down by teleprinter or by telephone to the plot room in the tunnel, which meant that a coloured pin could be stuck in a particular place on the plot. Then if the officer in charge, which could be me, after evaluating the quality of the signal and talking to the operator who'd taken it, felt that it was a genuine one and that it was accurate enough, a signal would be sent out to the convoys and to any hunter groups to watch out for that particular submarine. And that's one of the ways that the Battle of the Atlantic was was operated.
You say that the listening system was refined so that they could get on to these signals. How was that done? Because they came up and broadcast on a specific frequency. How did they know which frequency?
Well, because by experience, the Admiralty and the various listening stations had exchanged information. By experience, they found the sort of frequencies that you should listen to. They trained the operators to listen through all the crackle and noise that went on for that particular type of signal. They obviously were all good at Morse, and they were very accurate. And the interesting thing is that the wireless station was manned partly by seamen, by telegraphists, I mean naval telegraphists, partly by Wrens, and partly by civilians, Admiralty civilians, who were very experienced wireless operators.
How many wireless operators would there be?
I think there were something like 24 in all, but I may be wrong. Now, there were about 12 Wrens, it must have been more than 24, about 12 Wrens, about the same number of telegraphists, and about half a dozen civilians.
Would the signals be in code?
Yes, they were in code, in cipher. And then they were sent sometimes you got longer signals, and they would all be taken down anyway, and by routine they would be sent to Admiralty, and I think they ended up in Bletchley.
So all you'd get is a dots and dashes of
Morse,
right. Record
that would be recorded, and we didn't know what the content was. We just knew it was that type of signal,
so your
which had a very characteristic beginning, a prefix which they could recognise.
So you wouldn't know what that signal said or what it
was
about.
No, wouldn't.
So you just used it for direction.
That's right, and for alerting the plot, yes.
Were you connected with any of the other intelligence things? Were you aware of things like Ultra and that sort of thing?
Yes, we knew about it because we used to send the signals we picked up to the Bletchley Park people to be deciphered.
They would be in this Ultra code?
Yes. Or so we thought. We didn't know much detail, but some of us, not me, but some of the other people with me, had actually been on a training course at Bletchley. So that it was all very hush-hush, and at the same time, it was known. It was a funny mixture of, you weren't supposed to know it existed, but you did.
Did any of your fellow officers talk to you about these training courses at Bletchley? Did they say what was going on, or did they keep mum?
Well, they told me what they had not been trained in Ultra itself, but they had been trained in what was needed to decipher German signals, so that there wasn't an awful lot to talk about except the detail, which wasn't very interesting. But they did say they'd been there. Yes. Oh, yes.
Would you have a German speaker on call at all?
No, because as I say, it was all in cipher. All we got was letters and numbers.
What was your role there? Was to decide what sort of...
My role was two things. One was to keep the place going properly, up on the top of the rock, to keep the signals, the wireless station operating. And the other was to run the plot. Well, what that involved was the normal duties of a divisional officer, keeping the men and the girls happy. There was a very experienced chief petty officer, a yeoman of signals, who ran it, who was a very humorous type, and he was up there all the time, a sort of grandfather figure, although I'm sure he wasn't more than about 45, really. He seemed very old. The girls had a bedroom up there which they could sleep in when they were on a night watch and didn't have to all be on at the same time, and the men had a little camp with Nissen huts under the trees a bit further down. But although that sounds a bit odd now, there was never any problem sexually or anything like that. There was a great feeling of comradeship, and the girls were all very educated girls. The first lot, when I arrived, were all given the rank of Chief Petty Officer Wrens, but they all went because they'd been there too long, and the new lot were just ordinary telegraphists, but they were all sort of officers' daughters, that kind of person. The men, of course, were just ordinary telegraphists. But again, there was no trouble. There was a nice... They all worked side by side together.
What sort of equipment did you have in this station?
Radio receiving sets.
A lot of them?
Yes. A whole... it was a small room with a whole lot of them side by side all around the room. And they were all just listening away all the time. I knew nothing about the technical side of it. My Morse code wasn't terribly good. I'd only had very basic training in it. And I wasn't involved in that side at all. I had to rely on their judgment as to whether something was a signal worth capturing, and I had to rely on the judgment of the few telegraphists doing the direction finding as to whether they had got the right direction.
And then you just passed
it on. And then I passed it on. And my role, when I was on the plot, when I was acting as assistant staff officer Y, which was my title, A-S-O-Y, was to decide on what they told me whether it was worth bothering everybody with a reasonably good fix and a reasonably accurate capture of a signal. And that was quite a responsibility, especially if you've been asleep, lying on a filthy camp bed in this underground thing at night. Somebody suddenly wakes you up with a signal. You have to decide what to do.
What criteria did you use?
Was the operator satisfied that the signal was clear and that he'd got it right, and that it really was one? And there were sometimes other kinds of signals. Had the direction and so on been established properly? Had it been confirmed by fixes from other stations? Because if other stations picked up the same signal and there was a converging fix, then you had a greater confidence, and you knew this because they would telegraph through to us. Again, in cipher, you know, it's all very complicated. So then I had to decide,
who would decipher those signals within?
The station, as far as I remember. Or, no, I'm not sure whether it went to a cipher office in the rock or whether it came from up top. But certainly I would receive something which showed me that a whole series of fixes had been made. I think it came from the station. And so then I was able to plot these on the plot. And if I got a blob with an enormous circle of uncertainty around it, then it was very difficult for me to do more than just a routine information signal. If it was something that seemed more urgent, then it was my job, sometimes I was the officer of the watch in charge of the plot, the whole plot. Then I would, well, not the senior one, but the one actually running it, I would then have to decide, is it worth alarming everyone and sending a signal up? Well, I did this on a couple of occasions, and once there was a very good sharp signal in the straits themselves. They actually got a German submarine which had surfaced, and I sent a signal out, and it was sunk. So I felt it was my contribution to the war. I also felt very guilty afterwards because I thought, God, it was my fault all these people got killed in the submarine. But it was a very clear signal, and it was so clear that no one believed it. It was very doubtful whether it could really be true, and it was true. So I took the right decision.
By directional thoughts.
No, it was just very loud, and therefore seemed to be very near, and it therefore seemed to be accurate, because you sometimes could get a beam which said a submarine was in a certain place. In fact, it was miles away because of all sorts of funny things happening with the signal beams. Anyway, it was sunk, and they recovered a kitten and a lavatory seat from it.
What exactly were, then, your duties overall in charge of the plot? No.
Well, normally there was an enormous number of people running it, especially in the daytime. And my job then was to contribute to an overall view of it, although, as I said, I wasn't in charge of the whole operation, because a fairly senior person was. Now, there was a big plot horizontally on the table, and there was also at least one other plot on the wall, like you see in films of the aircraft plots. And they were run mostly by these Wren officers.
How did they differ, the table and the...
I think the one on the wall was more detailed of certain parts, and it had information that changed from time to time. But we were supposed to know what was happening. We had all kinds of signals coming in saying where different convoys were, when the next convoy was due out, where submarines had been sighted. And the way it was done was believed submarine, such a place. It wasn't referred to as where the information came from, because sometimes it was from sightings by ships or aircraft. Some of the Wren officers were quite interesting. I remember one of them was Sir Stafford Cripps' daughter, I think, which I thought was quite interesting, because Stafford Cripps at that time was a controversial character.
How was the plot actually... Who did what to get all this information on?
Well, different people had different responsibilities. Mostly the Wren officers were responsible for sticking pins or moving counters about with things like croupiers, pushers. And then various people like myself would have different aspects of the job of coordinating or interpreting or being aware of what was happening. And then the senior officer in charge, who I think normally was a commander, again on different watches, would be the one responsible for making the final decision as to what was going on and having the whole picture in his mind. If a signal came in, like the one I sent, with new information, then the officer of the watch concerned, which might be me at night, would have to make the decision to send a signal out to the local anti-submarine flotilla, for instance. We also collaborated with the aircraft, with the Air Force. We used to be visited from time to time. We had our own little plot, which we kept. We used to be visited by the Admiral and by the senior Air Force. I think he was a Vice Marshal who would look at things. And at that time, they had a boffin, as he was called, a civilian mathematical expert, who I think was engaged by the Air Force, who was supposed to look at the plots and make statistical judgments about probability and about where things might be as a guide to the best deployment of resources. Now, I remember thinking at the time, what an idiotic thing this was, how stupid, etc., like most of my colleagues. Now, since then, having worked much, much later on things like forecasting methodology, I can see what the point was, that you can use statistics, some people do, to give you an idea of the probability of certain things happening, although I still think it was wrongly applied to hunting submarines in wartime. Anyway, all that kind of thing went on.
You said you had your own small plot. What
yes.
was that?
Well, that was a plot on which we put only the submarines and the various possibilities as to where they might be that we'd received over a period of, say, 24 hours.
Could you, by looking at the plot, understand what was happening yourself?
Yes, you've got a general view. You could see different coloured bits moving which represented convoys of different speeds, and you could see places where there might have been submarines a few hours before. You got a general view, yes.
When a convoy was moving and was on a course, how often would it be moved, the markers for it, roughly speaking?
I don't remember exactly, but say once an hour or once every couple of times, maybe not as often as once an hour, certainly during a watch they would be moved at least once and possibly more.
If a convoy was heading towards an area where there had been an awful lot of submarine messages, I mean, I know it was very vague,
yes.
But would you send the convoy?
Oh, yes, they'd be warned.
Or tell them to go round it?
Yes, what happened was there was a system, as far as I remember, of regular signals to convoys, a daily state sheet or some such name, which gave them all the latest information. And it didn't say where the information had come from. It just said submarine activity reported in area so-and-so, or very strong possibility of submarines in such-and-such an area, that kind of thing. And then the convoys had the duty, well, they would be rerouted, of course, but they also had some duty about taking their own initiative if they thought that something was getting too close to them.
Who would reroute them?
The Admiral, in theory, the Admiral's staff, the headquarters, in other words. Staff Officer Operations, SOO.
Did the Germans seem to know that they were being overheard, or that British intelligence was on to this sort of thing?
Well, we assumed that they must know that people were trying to listen to them, which is why you have radio silence, wireless silence, it was called then. But we also all believed that they didn't know that they were being picked up. We thought that they thought they were so clever that they'd invented this very short signal. It's a special type of code that they used with a certain format, that they didn't know they were being picked up. That's what we thought at the time. I'm not sure which is true.
What was the special format? Can you remember?
Well, it just had a prefix of what was called B barred, a B, which in Morse code, if you have an accented B, you do a sort of double B, dash, dot, 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 twice. I think that's what it was, or maybe with a special thing. It was called B barred, B accented. And that was the prefix, which meant that they were a submarine popping up to send a signal. And then a very short string, which obviously had some kind of pre-established cipher saying something like, my position is so-and-so, what do I do next?
How long would it last for?
Oh, a few seconds. Very, very quick. And that's why we thought, they probably thought they weren't being picked up.
Did their tactics start to change at all? Did they not Yes. become suspicious as they kept...
Well, I don't know if it's that, or whether it's because they had more submarines, or because the convoy system was so successful, but round about that time they did start to operate in wolf packs, where they would home in on a particular target in large numbers. And I'm not sure, but I think they began to use these signals differently. They didn't need them so much. On the other hand, I've since wondered how they kept in touch with each other when they were in the wolf packs. At the time, it never occurred to me. I think they must have sometimes signalled when they were getting together. And so that must have made more signalling. But of course, I didn't listen in myself. I only got the results.
What was the actual reason for you? I mean, you'd ask for a posting like this because of your languages, and I can't see any need for your languages.
No. Well, I've often wondered this, and I think it may be because I'd done this extra navigation, you see. Although I didn't actually have to use navigation, but it meant I was familiar with plots, charts, and all that sort of thing. It may be just pure coincidence. Or it may be that somebody thought that speaking Spanish was an advantage in Gibraltar. I'm not sure. It wasn't, actually.
How did your job interact with the rest of the staff and intelligence?
Well, it was a bit special. It didn't interact with intelligence that I knew of. We interacted more with the operations. In other words, with the plot. And I felt I was part of that. Most of the more senior officers were RN, which isn't surprising because they had a big responsibility. The Wren officers were a very charming lot, but slightly snooty. They kept themselves to themselves. I remember I had my 21st birthday there, and I was desperate to have a big party and didn't know enough people. And I invited one of them, the more glamorous and sophisticated ones, and she didn't come. And I always thought it's because I seemed too young and sort of unimpressive. They mixed much more with the more glamorous older types. But they were a nice lot, and I didn't get to know them personally all that well because I was either on the top of the rock looking after the station or on watch. Middle Hill, it was called, Middle Hill Wireless Station. But I got to know our own people, and one of the Wrens in particular that was under my command, I got very friendly with, which I wasn't... I don't think it mattered because we didn't show her any favouritism, but I really became very keen on her and was very annoyed when she got married to someone else later. They were a very nice bunch, and particularly the ones, the operators, very dedicated. It was very hard work. Yes, the girls slept on the rock, as I told you, when they were on watch. And one day, there was a story that one of the rock monkeys had got in among them. And there was a great panic, but in fact it wasn't true. It just made a good story to keep the men out, I think.